Chapter 10. It was nearly 3 weeks more, passing wholly without incident, before they sighted the island of New Amsterdam. Temeraire delighted by the glistening heaps of seals, most sunbathing lazily upon the beaches, and the more energetic coming to the ship to frolic in her wake. They were not shy of the sailors, nor even of the marines, who were inclined to use them for target practice, but when Temeraire descended into the water they vanished away at once, and even those on the beach humped themselves sluggishly further away from the waterline. Deserted, Temeraire swam about the ship in a disgruntled circle, then climbed back aboard. He had grown more adept at this manoeuvre with practice, and now barely set the allegiance to bobbing. The seals gradually returned, and did not seem to object to him peering down at them more closely, though they dived deep again if he put his head too far into the water. They had been carried southward by the storm nearly into the 40s, and had lost almost all their easting as well, a cost of more than a week's sailing. "The one benefit is that I think the monsoon has set in finally," Riley said, consulting Lawrence over his charts. "From here we can strike out for the Dutch East Indies directly. It will be a good month and a half without landfall, but I have sent the boats to the island, and with a few days of sealing to add to what we already have, we should do nicely." The barrels of seal meat, salted down, stank profoundly, and 2 dozen more fresh carcasses were hung in meat lockers from the catheads to keep them cool. The next day, out at sea again, the Chinese cooks butchered almost half of these on deck, throwing the heads, tails, and entrails overboard with shocking waste, and served Temeraire a heap of steaks, lightly seared.
"It is not bad, with a great deal of pepper, and perhaps more of those roasted onions," he said after tasting, now grown particular.
Still as anxious to please as ever, they at once altered the dish to his liking. He then devoured the whole with pleasure, and laid himself down for a long nap, wholly oblivious to the great disapproval of the ship's cook and quartermasters, and the crew in general. The cooks had not cleaned after themselves, and the upper deck was left nearly awash in blood. This having taken place in the afternoon, Riley did not see how he could ask the men to wash the decks a second time for the day. The smell was overpowering, as Lawrence sat down to dinner with him and the other senior officers, especially as the small windows were obliged to be kept shut to avoid the still more pungent smell of the remaining carcasses hanging outside. Unhappily, Riley's cook had thought along the same lines as the Chinese cooks. The main dish upon the table was a beautifully golden pie, a week's worth of butter gone into the pastry, along with the last of the fresh peas from Cape Town, accompanied by a bowl of bubbling hot gravy. But when cut into, the smell of the seal meat was too distinctly recognisable, and the entire table picked at their plates.
"It is no use," Riley said with a sigh, and scraped his serving back into the platter. "Take it down to the midshipman's mess, Jethson, and let them have it. It would be a pity to waste."
They all followed suit and made do with the remaining dishes, but it created a sad vacancy on the table, and as the steward carried away the platter he could be heard through the door talking loudly of "foreigners what don't know how to behave civilized and spoil people's appetite." They were passing around the bottle for consolation when the ship gave a queer jerk, a small hop in the water, unlike anything Lawrence had ever felt. Riley was already going to the door when Purbeck said suddenly,
"Look there!"
and pointed out the window. The chain of the meat locker was dangling loose, and the cage was gone. They all stared. Then a confusion of yells and screams erupted on deck, and the ship yawed abruptly to starboard, with the gunshot sound of cracking wood. Riley rushed out, the rest of them hard on his heels. As Lawrence went up the ladderway, another crash shook her. He slipped down 4 rungs and nearly knocked Granby off the ladder. They popped out onto the deck, jack-in-the-box fashion, all of them together. A bloody leg with buckled shoe and silk stockings was lying across the larboard gangway, all that was left of Reynolds, who had been the midshipman on duty. And 2 more bodies had fetched up against a splintered half-moon gap in the railing, apparently bludgeoned to death. On the Dragon deck, Temeraire was sitting up on his haunches, looking around wildly. The other men on deck were leaping up into the rigging, or scrambling for the forward ladderway, struggling against the midshipmen who were trying to come up.
"Run up the colours!"
Riley said, shouting over the noise, even as he leapt to try and grapple with the double wheel, calling several other sailors to come and help him. Basson, the coxswain, was nowhere to be seen,
and the ship was still drifting off her course. She was moving steadily, so they had not grounded on a reef, and there was no sign of any other ship, the horizon clear all around.
"Beat to quarters!"
The drum roll started and drowned out any hope of learning what was going on, but it was the best means of getting the panicking men back into order, the most urgent matter of business.
"Mr. Garnet, get the boats over the side, if you please," Purbeck called loudly, striding out to the middle of the rail, fixing on his hat.
He had, as usual, worn his best coat to dinner and made a tall, official figure.
"Griggs, Masterson, what do you mean by this?" he said, addressing a couple of the hands, peering down fearfully from the tops. "Your grog is stopped for a week. Get down and go along to your guns."
Lawrence pushed forward along the gangway, forcing a lane against the men now running to their proper places. One of the marines, hopping past, trying to pull on a freshly blacked boot, his hands greasy and slipping on the leather. The gun crews for the aft carronades scrambling over one another.
"Lawrence! Lawrence! What is it?" Temeraire called, seeing him. "I was asleep. What has happened?"
The Allegiance rocked abruptly over to one side, and Lawrence was thrown against the railing. On the far side of the ship, a great jet of water fountained up and came splashing down upon the deck, and a monstrous, draconic head lifted up above the railing. Enormous, luridly orange eyes set behind a rounded snout, with ridges of webbing tangled with long trailers of black seaweed. An arm was still dangling from the creature's mouth, limply. It opened its maw and threw its head back with a jerk, swallowing the rest. Its teeth were washed bright red with blood. Riley called for the starboard broadside, and on deck Purbeck was drawing three of the gun crews together around one of the carronades. He meant them to point it at the creature directly. They were casting loose its tackles, the strongest men blocking the wheels, all sweating and utterly silent but for low grunting, working as fast as they could, greenish pale. The 42-pounder could not be easily handled.
"Fire! Fire, you fucking yellow-assed millers!"
MacReady yelling hoarsely in the tops, already reloading his own gun. The other marines belatedly set off a ragged volley, but the bullets did not penetrate. The serpentine neck was clad in thickly overlapping scales, blue and silver gilt. The sea serpent made a low croaking noise and lunged at the deck, striking two men flat and seizing another in its mouth. Doyle's shrieks could be heard even from within, his legs kicking frantically.
"No," Temeraire said. "Stop, arrêtez," and followed this with a string of words in Chinese also.
The serpent looked at him incuriously, with no sign of understanding, and bit down. Doyle's legs fell abruptly back to the deck, severed, blood spurting briefly in midair before they struck. Temeraire held quite motionless with staring horror, his eyes fixed on the serpent's crunching jaws, and his ruff completely flattened against his neck. Lawrence shouted his name, and he came alive again. The fore and mainmasts lay between him and the sea serpent. He could not come at the creature directly, so he leapt off the bow and winged around the ship in a tight circle to come up behind it. The sea serpent's head turned to follow his movement, rising higher out of the water. It laid spindly forelegs on the Allegiance's railing as it lifted itself out, webbing stretched between unnaturally long taloned fingers. Its body was much narrower than Temeraire's, thickening only slightly along its length, but in size its head was larger, with eyes larger than dinner platters, terrible in their unblinking, dull savagery. Temeraire dived. His talons skidded along the silver hide, but he managed to find purchase by putting his forearms nearly around the body. Despite the serpent's length, it was narrow enough for him to grasp. The serpent croaked again, gurgling deep in its throat, and clung to the Allegiance, the sagging, jowly folds of flesh along its throat working with its cries. Temeraire set himself and hauled back, wings beating the air furiously. The ship leaned dangerously under their combined force, and yells could be heard from the hatchways, where water was coming in through the lowest gun ports.
"Temeraire, cut loose!" Lawrence shouted. "She will overset!"
Temeraire was forced to let go. The serpent seemed to only have a mind to get away from him now. It crawled forward onto the ship, knocking askew the mainsail yards and tearing the rigging as it came, head weaving from side to side. Lawrence saw his own reflection weirdly elongated in the black pupil,
Then the serpent blinked sideways, a thick, translucent sheath of skin sliding over the orb, and moved on past. Granby was pulling him back towards the ladderway. The creature's body was immensely long. Its head and forelegs vanished beneath the waves on the other side of the ship, and its hindquarters had not yet emerged, the scales shading to deeper blue and purple iridescence as the length of it kept coming, undulating onwards. Lawrence had never seen one even a tenth the size. The Atlantic serpents reached no more than 12 feet, even in the warm waters off the coast of Brazil, and those in the Pacific dived when ships drew near, rarely seen as anything more than fins breaking the water. The master's mate Sackler was coming up the ladderway, panting, with a big silver spade 7 inches wide, hastily tied onto a spar. He had been first mate on a South Seas whaler before being pressed.
"Sir, sir, tell them to where!
Oh, Christ, it'll lube us!" he yelled up, seeing Lawrence through the opening, even as he threw the spade onto the deck and hauled himself out after. With the reminder, Lawrence remembered on occasion seeing a swordfish or tunny hauled up with a sea serpent wrapped about it, strangling. It was their favourite means of seizing prey. Riley had heard the warning also. He was calling for axes, swords. Lawrence seized one from the first basket handed up the ladderway and began chopping next to a dozen other men, but the body moved on without stopping. They made some cuts into pale grey-white blubber, but did not even reach flesh, nowhere near cutting through.
"The head! Watch for the head!"
Sackler said, standing at the rail with a cutting spade ready, hands clenched and shifting anxiously around the pole. Lawrence handed off his axe and went to try and give Temeraire some direction. He was still hovering above in frustration, unable to grapple with the sea serpent while it was so entangled with the ship's masts and rigging. The sea serpent's head broke the water again on the same side, just as Sackler had warned, and the coils of the body began to draw tight. The Allegiance groaned, and the railing cracked and began to give way under the pressure. Purbeck had the gun positioned and ready.
"Steady it, men! Wait for the down-roll!"
"Wait! Wait!" Temeraire called.
Lawrence could not see why. Purbeck ignored him and called out,
"Fire!"
The carronade roared, and the shot went flying across the water, struck the sea serpent on the neck, and flew onwards before sinking. The creature's head was knocked sideways by the impact, and a burning smell of cooked meat rose, but the blow was not mortal. It only gargled in pain and began to tighten still further. Purbeck never flinched, steady though the serpent's body was, scarcely half a foot away from him now.
"Spand your gun,"
he said as soon as the smoke had died away, setting the men on another round. But it would be another 3 minutes at least before they could fire again, hampered by the awkward position of the gun and the confusion of 3 gun crews flung together. Abruptly, a section of the starboard railing just by the gun burst under the pressure into great jagged splinters, as deadly as those scattered by cannon fire. One stabbed Purbeck deep in the flesh of the arm, purple staining his coat sleeve instantly. Chervins threw up his arms, gargling around the shard in his throat, and slumped over the gun. De Vith hauled his body off onto the floor, never flagging despite the splinter stuck right through his jaw, the other end poking out the underside of his chin and dripping blood. Temeraire was still hovering back and forth near the serpent's head, growling at it. He had not roared, perhaps afraid of doing so, close to the Allegiance. A wave like that which had destroyed the Valerie would sink them just as easily as the serpent itself. Lawrence was on the verge of ordering him to take the risk, regardless. The men were hacking, frantically, but the tough hide was resisting them, and in any moment the Allegiance might be broken beyond repair. If her futtocks cracked, or worse, the keel bent, they might never be able to bring her into port again. But before he could call, Temeraire suddenly gave a low, frustrated cry, beat up into the air and folded his wings shut. He fell like a stone, claws outstretched, and struck the sea serpent's head directly, driving it below the water's surface. His momentum drove him beneath the waves also, and a deep, purpling cloud of blood filled the water.
"Temeraire!"
Lawrence cried, scrambling heedless over the shuddering, jerking body of the serpent, half crawling and half running along the length of the blood-slippery deck. He climbed out over the rail and onto the mainmast chains while Granby grabbed at him and missed. He kicked his boots off into the water, no very coherent plan in mind. He could swim only a little, and he had no knife or gun. Granby was trying to climb out to join him,
but could not keep his feet with the ship sawing to and fro like a nursery rocking horse. Abruptly a great shiver travelled in reverse along the silver-grey length of the serpent's body, which was all that was visible. Its hindquarters and tail surfaced in a convulsive leap, then fell back into the water with a tremendous splash, and it lay still at last. Temeraire popped back out through the surface like a cork, bouncing part way out of the water and splashing down again. He coughed and spluttered and spat. There was blood all over his jaws.
"I think she is dead," he said, between his wheezing gasps for air, and slowly paddled himself to the ship's side.
He did not climb aboard, but leaned against the Allegiance, breathing deeply and relying on his native buoyancy to keep him afloat. Lawrence clambered over to him on the fretwork like a boy, and perched there stroking him, as much for his own comfort as Temeraire's. Temeraire being too weary to climb back aboard at once, Lawrence took one of the small boats and pulled Canes around to inspect him for any signs of injury. There were some scratches, in one wound an ugly, saw-edged tooth lodged, but none severe. Canes, however, listened to Temeraire's chest again and looked grave, and opined that some water had entered the lungs. With much encouragement from Lawrence, Temeraire pulled himself back aboard. The Allegiance sagged more than usual, both from his fatigue and her own state of disarray, but he eventually managed to climb back aboard, though causing some fresh damage to the railing. Not even Lord Purbeck, devoted as he was to the ship's appearance, begrudged Temeraire the cracked banisters. Indeed, a tired but whole-hearted cheer went up as he thumped down at last.
"Put your head down over the side," Canes said, once Temeraire was fairly established on the deck.
He groaned a little, wanting only to sleep, but obeyed. After leaning precariously far and complaining in a stifled voice that he was growing dizzy, he did manage to cough up some quantity of salt water. Having satisfied Canes, he shuffled himself slowly backwards until his position on the deck was more secure, and curled into a heap.
"Will you have something to eat?" Lawrence said. "Something fresh? A sheep? I will have them prepare it for you however you like."
"No, Lawrence, I cannot eat anything, not at all," Temeraire said, muffled, his head hidden under his wing and a shudder visible between his shoulder blades. "Pray let them take her away."
The body of the sea serpent still lay sprawled across the Allegiance. The head had bobbed to the surface on the larboard side, and now the whole impressive extent of it could be seen. Riley sent men in boats to measure it from nose to tail. More than 250 feet. At least twice the length of the largest regal copper Lawrence had ever heard of, which had rendered it thus capable of encircling the whole vessel, though its body was less than 25 feet in diameter.
"Kiao, a sea dragon," Sun Kai called it, having come up on deck to see what had happened.
He informed them that there were similar creatures in the China Sea, though ordinarily smaller. No one suggested eating it. After the measurements had been done, and the Chinese poet, also something of an artist, permitted to render an illustration, the axes were applied to it once more. Sackler led the effort with practiced strokes of the cutting spade, and Pratt severed the thick, armoured column of the spine with 3 heavy blows. After this, its own weight and the slow forward motion of the Allegiance did the rest of the work almost at once. The remaining flesh and hide parted with a sound like tearing fabric, and its separate halves slid away off the opposite sides. There was already a great deal of activity in the water around the body, sharks tearing at the head and other fishes also. Now an increasingly furious struggle arose around the hacked and bloody ends of the two halves.
"Let us get underway as best we can," Riley said to Purbeck.
Though the main and mizzen sails and rigging had been badly mauled, the foremast and its rigging were untouched, but for a few tangled ropes, and they managed to get a small spread of sail before the wind. They left the corpse drifting on the surface behind them and got under way. In an hour or so it was little more than a silvery line on the water. Already the deck had been washed down, freshly scrubbed and sanded with holy stone, and sluiced clean again, water pumped up with great enthusiasm, and the carpenter and his mates were engaged in cutting a couple of spars to replace the mainsail and mizzen topsail yards. The sails had suffered greatly. Spare sailcloth had to be brought up from stores, and this was found to have been rat-chewed to Riley's fury. Some hurried patchwork was done, but the sun was setting, and the fresh cordage could not be rigged until morning.
The men were let go by watches to supper and then to sleep, without the usual inspection. Still barefoot, Lawrence took some coffee and ship's biscuit when Roland brought it him, but stayed by Temeraire, who remained subdued and without appetite. Lawrence tried to coax him out of the low spirits, worried that perhaps he had taken some deeper injury, not immediately apparent, but Temeraire said dully, "No, I am not hurt at all, nor sick. I am perfectly well."
"Then what has distressed you so?" Lawrence at length asked tentatively. "You did so very well today and saved the ship."
"All I did was kill her. I do not see it is anything to be so proud of," Temeraire said. "She was not an enemy, fighting us for some cause. I think she only came because she was hungry, and then I suppose we frightened her with the shooting, and that is why she attacked us. I wish I could have made her understand and leave."
Lawrence stared. It had not occurred to him that Temeraire might not have viewed the sea serpent as the monstrous creature it seemed to him.
"Temeraire, you cannot think that beast anything like a dragon," he said. "It had no speech, nor intelligence. I dare say you are right that it came looking for food, but any animal can hunt."
"Why should you say such things?" Temeraire said. "You mean that she did not speak English or French or Chinese, but she was an ocean creature. How ought she have learned any human languages if she was not tended by people in the shell? I would not understand them myself otherwise, but that would not mean I did not have intelligence."
"But surely you must have seen she was quite without reason," Lawrence said. "She ate 4 of the crew and killed 6 others. Men, not seals, and plainly not dumb beasts. If she were intelligent, it would have been inhuman, uncivilized," he amended, stumbling over his choice of words. "No one has ever been able to tame a sea serpent. Even the Chinese do not say differently."
"You may as well say that if a creature will not serve people and learn their habits, it is not intelligent and had just as well be killed," Temeraire said, his ruff quivering.
He had lifted his head, stirred up.
"Not at all," Lawrence said, trying to think of how he could give comfort.
To him the lack of sentience in the creature's eyes had been wholly obvious.
"I am saying only that if they were intelligent, they would be able to learn to communicate, and we would have heard of it. After all, many dragons do not choose to take on a handler, and refuse to speak with men at all. It has not happened so very often, but it does, and no one thinks dragons unintelligent for it," he added, thinking he had chanced on a happy example.
"But what happens to them if they do?" Temeraire said. "What should happen to me if I were to refuse to obey? I do not mean a single order. What if I did not wish to fight in the corps at all?"
So far, this had all been general. The suddenly narrower question startled Lawrence, giving the conversation a more ominous cast. Fortunately, there was little work to be done with so light a spread of sail. The sailors were gathered on the forecastle, gambling with their grog rations and intent on their game of dice. The handful of aviators remaining on duty were talking together softly at the rail. There was no one likely to overhear, for which Lawrence was grateful. Others might misunderstand and think Temeraire unwilling, even disloyal in some way. For his own part, he could not believe there was any real risk of Temeraire's choosing to leave the corps and all his friends. He tried to answer calmly.
"Feral dragons are housed in the breeding grounds very comfortably. If you chose, you might live there also. There is a large one in the north of Wales, on Cardigan Bay, which I understand is very beautiful."
"And if I did not care to live there, but wished to go somewhere else?"
"But how would you eat?" Lawrence said. "Herds which could feed a dragon would be raised by men, and their property."
"If men have penned up all the animals and left none wild, I cannot think it reasonable of them to complain if I take one now and again," Temeraire said. "But even making such allowance, I could hunt for fish. What if I chose to live near Dover and fly as I liked and eat fish and did not bother anyone's herds? Should I be allowed?"
Too late, Lawrence saw he had wandered onto dangerous ground, and bitterly regretted having led the conversation in this direction. He knew perfectly well Temeraire would be allowed nothing of the sort. People would be terrified at the notion of a dragon living loose among them, no matter how peaceable the dragon might be. The objections to such a scheme would be many and reasonable, and yet from Temeraire's perspective the denial would represent an unjust curtailment of his liberties. Lawrence could not think how to reply without aggravating his sense of injury. Temeraire took his silence for the answer it was, and nodded.
"If I would not go, I should be put in chains again and dragged off," he said. I would be forced to go to the breeding grounds, and if I tried to leave I would not be allowed, and the same for any other dragon. So it seems to me," he added grimly, a suggestion of a low, growling anger beneath his voice, "that we are just like slaves, only there are fewer of us, and we are much bigger and dangerous. So we are treated generously where they are treated cruelly, but we are still not free."
"Good God, that is not so," Lawrence said, standing up, appalled, dismayed, at his own blindness as much as the remark. Small wonder if Temeraire had flinched from the storm chains, if such a train of thought had been working through his imagination before now, and Lawrence did not believe that it could be the result solely of the recent battle.
"No, it is not so. Wholly unreasonable," Lawrence repeated.
He knew himself inadequate to debate with Temeraire on most philosophical grounds, but the notion was inherently absurd, and he felt he must be able to convince Temeraire of the fact, if only he could find the words.
"It is as much to say that I am a slave, because I am expected to obey the orders of the Admiralty. If I refused, I would be dismissed the service and very likely hanged. That does not mean I am a slave."
"But you have chosen to be in the Navy and the Corps," Temeraire said. "You might resign if you wished and go elsewhere."
"Yes, but then I should have to find some other profession to support myself, if I did not have enough capital to live off the interest. And indeed, if you did not wish to be in the Corps, I have enough to purchase an estate somewhere in the north, or perhaps Ireland, and stock the grounds. You might live there exactly as you liked, and no one could object."
Lawrence breathed again as Temeraire mulled this over. The militant light had faded a little from his eyes, and gradually his tail ceased its restless mid-air twitching, and coiled again into a neatly spiralled heap upon the deck, the curving horns of his ruff lying more easily against his neck. 8 bells rang softly, and the sailors left their dice game, the new watch coming on deck to put out the last handful of lights. Ferris came up the dragon deck stairs, yawning, with a handful of fresh crewmen still rubbing the sleep from their eyes. Balesworth led the earlier watch below, the men saying, "Good night, sir, good night, Temeraire," as they went by, many of them patting Temeraire's flank.
"Good night, gentlemen," Lawrence answered, and Temeraire gave a low, warm rumble.
"The men may sleep on deck if they like, Mr. Tripp,"
Purbeck was saying, his voice carrying along from the stern. The ship's night settled upon her, the men gladly dropping along the forecastle, heads pillowed on coiled hawsers and rolled-up shirts. All darkness but for the solitary stern lantern, winking far at the other end of the ship, and the starlight. There was no moon, but the Magellanic clouds were particularly bright, and the long cloudy mass of the Milky Way. Presently silence fell. The aviators also had disposed of themselves along the larboard railing, and they were again as nearly alone as they might be on board. Lawrence had sat down once more, leaning against Temeraire's side. There was a waiting quality to Temeraire's silence. And at length Temeraire said,
"But if you did,"
as if there had been no break in the conversation, although not with the same heat of anger as before,
"if you purchased an estate for me, that would still be your doing, and not mine. You love me, and would do anything you could to ensure my happiness. But what of a dragon like poor Levitas, with a captain of Rankin's sort, who did not care for his comfort? I do not understand what precisely capital is, but I am sure I have none of my own, nor any way of getting it."
He was at least not so violently distressed as before, but rather now sounded weary and a little sad. Lawrence said,
"You do have your jewels, you know. The pendant alone is worth some 10,000 pounds, and it was a clear gift. No one could dispute that it is your own property in law."
Temeraire bent his head to inspect the piece of jewellery, the breastplate which Lawrence had purchased for him with much of the prize money for the Amitié, the frigate which had carried his egg. The platinum had suffered some small dents and scratches in the course of the journey, which remained because Temeraire would not suffer to be parted from it long enough for them to be sanded out, but the pearl and sapphires were as brilliant as ever.
"So is that what capital is, then? Jewels? No wonder it is so nice. But, Lawrence, that makes no difference. It was still your present, after all, not something which I won myself."
"I suppose no one has ever thought of offering dragons a salary, or prize money. It is no lack of respect, I promise you, only that money does not seem to be of much use to dragons."
"It is of no use, because we are not permitted to go anywhere or do as we like, and so have nothing to spend it upon," Temeraire said. If I had money, I am sure I still could not go to a shop and buy more jewels or books. We are even chided for taking our food out of the pen when it suits us.
But it is not because you are a slave that you cannot go where you like, but because people would naturally be disturbed by it, and the public good must be consulted, Lawrence said. It would do you no good to go into town and to a shop if the keeper had fled before you came.
It is not fair that we should be thus restricted by others' fears, when we have not done anything wrong. You must see it is so, Lawrence.
No, it is not just, Lawrence said reluctantly. But people will be afraid of dragons no matter how they are told it is safe. It is plain human nature, foolish as it may be, and there is no managing around it. I am very sorry, my dear.
He laid his hand on Temeraire's side. I wish I had better answers for your objections.
I can only add to these that whatever inconveniences society may impose upon you, I would no more consider you a slave than myself, and I will always be glad to serve you in overcoming these as I may.
Temeraire huffed out a low sigh, but nudged Lawrence affectionately, and drew a wing down more closely about him. He said no more on the subject, but instead asked for the latest book, a French translation of the Arabian Nights, which they had found in Cape Town. Lawrence was glad enough to be allowed to thus escape, but uneasy. He did not think he had been very successful in the task of reconciling Temeraire to a situation with which Lawrence had always thought him well satisfied.
Part 3. Chapter 11. Allegiance. Macau.
Jane, I must ask you to forgive the long gap in this letter, and the few hasty words that are all by which I can amend the same now. I have not had leisure to take up my pen these 3 weeks. Since we passed out of Bunker Strait, we have been much afflicted by malarial fevers. I have escaped sickness myself, and most of my men, for which Keynes opines we must be grateful to Temeraire, believing that the heat of his body in some wise dispels the miasmas which cause the ague, and our close association thus affords some protection. But we have been spared only to increase of labour. Captain Riley has been confined to his bed since almost the very first, and Lord Purbeck, falling ill, I have stood watch in turn with the ship's third and fourth lieutenants, Franks and Beckett. Both are willing young men, and Franks does his best, but is by no means yet prepared for the duty of overseeing so vast a ship as the Allegiance, nor to maintain discipline among her crew. Stammers, I am sorry to say, which explains his seeming rudeness at table, which I had earlier remarked upon. This being summer, and Canton proper barred to Westerners, we will put in at Macau tomorrow morning, where the ship's surgeon hopes to find Jesuits' bark to replenish our supply, and I some British merchantmen, here out of season, to bear this home to you and to England. This will be my last opportunity, as by special dispensation from Prince Yongxing, we have permission to continue on northward to the Gulf of Jili, so we may reach Peking through Tianjin. The savings of time will be enormous, but as no Western ships are permitted north of Canton ordinarily, we cannot hope to find any British vessels once we have left port. We have passed 3 French merchantmen already in our approach, more than I had been used to see in this part of the world, though it has been some 7 years since the occasion of my last visit to Canton, and foreign vessels of all kinds are more numerous than formerly. At the present hour a sometimes obscuring fog lies over the harbour, and impedes the view of my glass, so I cannot be certain, but I fear there may also be a man-of-war, though perhaps Dutch rather than French. Certainly it is not one of our own. The Allegiance is, of course, in no direct danger, being on a wholly different scale, and under the protection of the Imperial Crown, which the French cannot dare to slight in these waters. But we fear that the French may have some embassy of their own in train, which must naturally have, or shortly form, the design of disrupting our own mission. On the subject of my earlier suspicions, I can say nothing more. No further attempts have been made, at least, though our sadly reduced numbers would have made easier any such stroke, and I begin to hope that Feng Li acted from some inscrutable motive of his own, and not at the behest of another. The bell has rung. I must go on deck. Allow me to send this, with all my affection and respect, and believe me always, your obedient servant, William Lawrence, June 16th, 1806.
The fog persisted through the night, lingering as the Allegiance made her final approach to Macau Harbour. a long curving stretch of sand circled by tidy square buildings in the Portuguese style and a neatly planted row of saplings had all the comfort of familiarity, and most of the junks, having their sails still furled, might almost have been small dinghies at anchor in Funchal or Portsmouth Roads. Even the softly eroded green-clad mountains, revealed as the grey fog trailed away, would not have been out of place in any Mediterranean port. Temeraire had been perched up on his hind quarters with eager anticipation. Now he gave up looking and lowered himself to the deck in dissatisfaction.
"Why, it does not look at all different," he said, cast down. "I do not see any other dragons either."
The Allegiance herself, coming in off the ocean, was under heavier cover, and her shape was not initially clear to those on shore, revealed only as the sluggishly creeping sun burnt off the mists, and she came farther into the harbour, a breath of wind pushing the fog off her bows. Then a nearly violent notice was taken. Lawrence had put in at the colony before, and expected some bustle, perhaps exaggerated by the immense size of the ship, quite unknown in these waters, but was taken aback by the noise which arose almost explosively from the shore.
"Tien Long! Tien Long!"
the cry carried across the water, and many of the smaller junks, more nimble, came bounding across the water to meet them, crowding each other so closely they often bumped each other's hulls, and the Allegiance herself, with all the hooting and shouting the crew could do to try and fend them off. More boats were being launched from the shore even as they let go the anchor, with much caution necessitated by their unwelcome close company. Lawrence was startled to see Chinese women coming down to the shore in their queer, mincing gait, some in elaborate and elegant dress, with small children and even infants in tow, and cramming themselves aboard any junk that had room to spare with no care for their garments. Fortunately, the wind was mild and the current gentle, or the wallowing, overloaded vessels would certainly have been overset with a terrible loss of life. As it was, they somehow made their way near the Allegiance, and when they drew near, the women seized their children and held them up over their heads, almost waving them in their direction. "What on earth do they mean by it?" Lawrence had never seen such an exhibition. By all his prior experience, the Chinese women were exceedingly careful to seclude themselves from Western gaze, and he had not even known so many lived in Macau at all. Their antics were drawing the curious attention of the Westerners of the port also now, both along the shore and upon the decks of the other ships with which they shared the harbour. Lawrence saw with sinking feelings that his previous night's assessment had not been incorrect, indeed rather short of the mark, for there were two French warships in the harbour, both handsome and trim, one a two-decker of some 64 guns, and the smaller a heavy frigate of 48. Temeraire had been observing with a great deal of interest, snorting in amusement at some of the infants, who looked very ridiculous in their heavily embroidered gowns, like sausages in silk and gold thread, and mostly wailing unhappily at being dangled in mid-air.
"I will ask them," he said,
and bent over the railing to address one of the more energetic women, who had actually knocked over a rival to secure a place at the boat's edge for herself and her offspring, a fat boy of maybe two who somehow managed to bear a resigned, phlegmatic expression on his round-cheeked face, despite being thrust nearly into Temeraire's teeth. He blinked at her reply and settled back on his haunches.
"I am not certain, because she does not sound quite the same," he said, "but I think she says they are here to see me."
Affecting unconcern, he turned his head, and with what he evidently thought were covert motions, rubbed at his hide with his nose, polishing away imaginary stains, and further indulged his vanity by arranging himself to best advantage, his head poised high and his wings shaken out and folded more loosely against his body. His ruff was standing broadly out in excitement.
"It is good luck to see a celestial,"
Yongxing seemed to think this perfectly obvious when applied to for some additional explanation.
"They would never have a chance to see one otherwise. They are only merchants."
He turned from the spectacle dismissively.
"We, with Liu Bao and Sun Kai, will be going on to Guangzhou to speak with the superintendent and the viceroy, and to send word of our arrival to the emperor,"
he said, using the Chinese name for Canton, and waited expectantly, so that Lawrence had perforce to offer him the use of the ship's barge for the purpose.
"I beg you will allow me to remind you, Your Highness, we may confidently expect to reach Tien Sing in 3 weeks' time,
so you may consider whether to hold any communications for the capital." Lawrence meant only to save him some effort. The distance was certainly better than 1,000 miles. But Yongxing very energetically made clear that he viewed this suggestion as nearly scandalous in its neglect of due respect to the throne, and Lawrence was forced to apologize for having made it, excusing himself by a lack of knowledge of local custom. Yongxing was not mollified. In the end, Lawrence was glad to pack him and the other two envoys off at the cost of the services of the barge, though it left him and Hammond only the jolly boat to convey them to their own rendezvous ashore. The ship's launch was already engaged in ferrying over fresh supplies of water and livestock.
"Is there anything I can bring you for your relief, Tom?" Lawrence asked, putting his head into Riley's cabin.
Riley lifted his head from the pillows where he lay before the windows and waved a weak, yellow-tinged hand.
"I am a good deal better, but I would not say no to a good port, if you can find a decent bottle in the place. I think my mouth has been turned down forever from the god-awful quinine."
Reassured, Lawrence went to take his leave of Temeraire, who had managed to coax the ensigns and runners into scrubbing him down, quite unnecessarily. The Chinese visitors were grown more ambitious, and had begun to throw gifts of flowers aboard, and other things also, less innocuous. Running up to Lawrence, very pale, Lieutenant Franks forgot to stutter in his alarm.
"Sir, they are throwing burning incense onto the ship. Pray, pray, make them stop!"
Lawrence climbed up to the dragon deck.
"Temeraire, will you please tell them nothing lit can be thrown at the ship? Roland, Dyer, mind what they throw, and if you see anything else that may carry a risk of fire, throw it back over at once. I hope they have better sense than to try setting off crackers," he added, without much confidence.
"I will stop them if they do," Temeraire promised. "You would see if there is somewhere I can come ashore?"
"I will, but I cannot hold out much hope. The entire territory is scarcely 4 miles square and thoroughly built up," Lawrence said. "But at least we can fly over it, and perhaps even over Canton, if the Mandarins do not object."
The English factory was built facing directly onto the main beach, so there was no difficulty in finding it. Indeed, their attention drawn by the gathered crowd, the company commissioners had sent a small welcoming party to await them on shore, led by a tall young man in the uniform of the East India Company's private service, with aggressive sideburns and a prominent aquiline nose, giving him a predatory look rather increased than diminished by the alert light in his eyes.
"Major Hertford at your service," he said, bowing. "And may I say, sir, we are damned glad to see you," he added, with a soldier's frankness once they were indoors. 16 months! We had begun to think no notice would be taken of it at all."
With an unpleasant shock, Lawrence was recalled to the memory of the seizure of the East India merchant ships by the Chinese all the long months ago. Preoccupied by his own concerns over Temeraire's status, and distracted by the voyage, he had nearly forgotten the incident entirely, but of course it could hardly have been concealed from the men stationed here. They would have spent the intervening months on fire to answer the profound insult.
"No action has been taken, surely?" Hammond asked, with an anxiety that gave Lawrence a fresh distaste for him.
There was a quality of fear to it.
"It would of all things be most prejudicial."
Hertford eyed him sidelong.
"No, the commissioners thought best under the circumstances to conciliate the Chinese and await some more official word,"
in a tone that left very little doubt of where his own inclinations would have led him. Lawrence could not but find him sympathetic, though in the ordinary course he did not think very highly of the company's private forces. But Hertford looked intelligent and competent, and the handful of men under his command showed signs of good discipline, their weapons well kept and their uniforms crisp, despite the nearly sopping heat. The boardroom was shuttered against the heat of the climbing sun, with fans laid ready at their places to stir the moist, stifling air. Glasses of claret punch, cooled with ice from the cellars, were brought once the introductions had been completed. The commissioners were happy enough to take the post which Lawrence had brought, and promised to see it conveyed back to England. This, concluding the exchange of pleasantries, they launched a delicate but pointed inquiry after the aims of the mission.
"Naturally, we are pleased to hear that government has compensated Captains Mestis and Holt and Gregson and the company, but I cannot possibly overstate the damage which the incident has done to our entire operations."
Sir George Staunton spoke quietly, but forcefully for all that. He was the chief of the commissioners, despite his relative youth, by virtue of his long experience of the nation. As a boy of 12 he had accompanied the Macartney embassy itself in his father's train, and was one of the few British men perfectly fluent in the language. Staunton described for them several more instances of bad treatment, and went on to say, "These are entirely characteristic, I'm sorry to say. The insolence and rapacity of the administration has markedly increased, and towards us only. The Dutch and the French meet with no such treatment. Our complaints, which previously they treated with some degree of respect, are now summarily dismissed, and in fact only draw worse down upon us."
"We have been almost daily fearing to be ordered out entirely," Mr. Grothingpile added to this.
He was a portly man, his white hair somewhat disordered by the vigorous action of his fan.
"With no insult to Major Hereford or his men," he nodded to the officer, "we will be hard-pressed to withstand such a demand, and you can be sure the French will be happy to help the Chinese enforce it."
"And to take our establishments for their own once we were expelled," Staunton added, to a circle of nodding heads. "The arrival of the allegiance certainly puts us in a different position, vis-à-vis the possibility of resistance." Here Hammond stopped him.
"Sir, I must beg leave to interrupt you. There is no contemplation of taking the allegiance into action against the Chinese Empire. None. You must put such a thought out of your minds entirely."
He spoke very decidedly, though he was certainly the youngest man at the table, except for Hereford. A palpable coolness resulted. Hammond paid no attention.
"Our first and foremost goal is to restore our nation to enough favour with the court to keep the Chinese from entering into an alliance with France. All other designs are insignificant by comparison."
"Mr. Hammond," Staunton said, "I cannot believe there is any possibility of such an alliance, nor that it can be so great a threat as you seem to imagine. The Chinese Empire is no Western military power, impressive as their size and their ranks of dragons may be to the inexperienced eye."
Hammond flushed at this small jab, perhaps not unintentional.
"And they are militantly uninterested in European affairs. It is a matter of policy with them to affect, even if not feel, a lack of concern with what passes beyond their borders, ingrained over centuries.
Their having gone to the lengths of dispatching Prince Yongxing to Britain must surely weigh with you, sir, as showing that a change in policy may be achieved, if the impetus be sufficient," Hammond said coolly.
They argued the point and many others with increasing politeness over the course of several hours. Lawrence had a struggle to keep his attention on the conversation, liberally laced as it was with references to names and incidents and concerns of which he knew nothing. Some local unrest among the peasants and the state of affairs in Tibet, where apparently some sort of outright rebellion was in progress, the trade deficit and the necessity of opening more Chinese markets, difficulties with the Inca over the South American route. But little though Lawrence felt able to form his own conclusions, the conversation served another purpose for him. He grew convinced that while Hammond was thoroughly informed, his view of the situation was in direct contradiction on virtually all points with the established opinions of the commissioners. In one instance, the question of the kowtow ceremony was raised and treated by Hammond as inconsequential. Naturally, they would perform the full ritual of genuflection, and by so doing, hopefully amend the insult given by Lord Macartney's refusal to do so in the previous embassy. Staunton objected forcefully.
"Yielding on this point, with no concessions in return, can only further degrade our standing in their eyes. The refusal was not made without reason. The ceremony is meant for envoys of tributary states, vassals of the Chinese throne, and having objected to it on these grounds before, we cannot now perform it without appearing to give way to the outrageous treatment they have meted out to us. It would of all things be most prejudicial to our cause, as giving them encouragement to continue."
"I can scarcely admit that anything could be more prejudicial to our cause than to wilfully resist the customs of a powerful and ancient nation in their own territory, because they do not meet our own notions of etiquette," Hammond said. "Victory on such a point can only be won by the loss of every other, as proved by the complete failure of Lord Macartney's embassy."
"I find I must remind you that the Portuguese prostrated themselves not only to the Emperor, but to his portrait and letters, at every demand the Mandarins made, and their embassy failed quite as thoroughly," Staunton said.
Lawrence did not like the notion of grovelling before any man, Emperor of China or no, but he thought it was not merely his own preferences which inclined him to Staunton's opinion on the matter. Abasement to such a degree could not help but provoke disgust even in a recipient who demanded the gesture, it seemed to him, and only lead to even more contemptuous treatment. He was seated on Staunton's left for dinner, and through their more casual conversation grew increasingly convinced of the man's good judgment, and all the more doubtful of Hammond's. At length they took their leave and returned to the beach to await the boat.
"This news about the French envoy worries me more than all the rest together," Hammond said, more to himself than to Lawrence. "De Guigne is dangerous. How I wish Bonaparte had sent anyone else."
Lawrence made no response. He was unhappily conscious that his own sentiments were much the same towards Hammond himself, and he would gladly have exchanged the man if he could. Prince Yongxing and his companions returned from their errand late the following day, but when applied to for permission to continue the journey, or even to withdraw from the harbour, he refused point blank, insisting that the allegiance should have to wait for further instructions. Whence these were to come, and when, he did not say, and in the meantime the local ships continued their pilgrimages even into the night, carrying great hanging paper lanterns in the bows to light their way. Lawrence struggled out of sleep very early the next morning to the sound of an altercation outside his door. Roland, sounding very fierce despite her clear, high treble, saying something in a mixture of English and Chinese, which she had begun to acquire from Temeraire.
"What is that damn noise there?"
he called strongly. She peered in through the door, which she held only a little ajar, wide enough for her eye and mouth. Over her shoulder he could see one of the Chinese servants making impatient gestures and trying to get at the doorknob.
"It is Huang, sir. He's making a fuss and says the prince wants you to come up to the deck at once, though I told him you had only gone to sleep after the middle watch."
He sighed and rubbed his face.
"Very good, Roland. Tell him I will come."
He was in no humour to be up. Late in his evening's watch, another visiting boat, piloted by a young man more entrepreneurial than skilled, had been caught broadside by a wave. Her anchor, improperly set, had come flying up and struck the Allegiance from beneath, jabbing a substantial hole in her hold and soaking much of the newly purchased grain. At the same time the little boat had overturned herself, and though the harbour was not distant, the passengers in their heavy silk garments could not make their own way to safety, but had to be fished out by lantern light. It had been a long and tiresome night, and he had been up watch and watch dealing with the mess before finally gaining his bed only in the small hours of the morning. He splashed his face with the tepid water in the basin and put on his coat with reluctance before going up to the deck. Temeraire was talking with someone. Lawrence had to look twice before he even realized that the other was in fact a dragon, like none he had ever seen before.
"Lawrence, this is Lung Yuping," Temeraire said, when Lawrence had climbed up to the dragon deck. "She has brought us the post."
Facing her, Lawrence found their heads were nearly on a level. She was smaller even than a horse, with a broad curving forehead and a long arrow-shaped muzzle, and an enormously deep chest, rather along greyhound proportions. She could not have carried anyone on her back except a child, and wore no harness but a delicate collar of yellow silk and gold, from which hung a fine mesh like thin chain mail, which covered her chest snugly, fixed to her forearms and talons by golden rings. The mesh was washed with gold, striking against her pale green hide. Her wings were a darker shade of green, and striped with narrow bands of gold. They were also unusual in appearance, narrow and tapered, and longer than she was. Even folded upon her back, their long tips dragged along the ground behind her like a train. When Temeraire had repeated the introductions in Chinese, the little dragon sat up on her haunches and bowed. Lawrence bowed in return, amused to greet a dragon thus on an equal plane. The forms satisfied, she poked her head forward to inspect him more closely, leaning over to look him up and down on both sides with great interest. Her eyes were very large and liquid, amber in colour, and thickly lidded. Hammond was standing and talking with Sun Kai and Liu Bao, who were inspecting a curious letter, thick and with many seals, the black ink liberally interspersed with vermilion markings. Yongxing stood a little way apart, reading a second missive, written in oddly large characters upon a long, rolled sheet of paper. He did not share this letter, but rolled it shut again, put it away privately, and rejoined the other three. Hammond bowed to them, and came to translate the news for Lawrence.
"We are directed to let the ship continue on to Tianxing, while we come on ahead by air," he said, "and they insist we must leave at once."
"Directed?" Lawrence asked in confusion. "But I do not understand. Where have these orders come from? We cannot have had word from Peking already. Prince Yongxing sent word only 3 days ago."
Temeraire addressed the question to Ping, who tilted her head and replied in deep, unfeminine tones which came echoing from her barrel chest.
"She says she brought it from a relay station at Heyuan, which is 400 of something called Li from here, and the flight is a little more than 2 hours," he said. "But I do not know what that means in terms of distance."
1 mile is 3 li, Hammond said, frowning as he tried to work it out.
Lawrence, quicker at figuring in his head, stared at her. If there was no exaggeration, that meant Yu Ping had covered better than 120 miles in her flight. At such a rate, with couriers flying in relays, the message could indeed have come from Peking, nearly 2,000 miles distant. The idea was incredible.
Yongxing, overhearing, said impatiently, "Our message is of highest priority, and travelled by jade dragons the entire route. Of course we have received word back. We cannot delay in this fashion when the Emperor has spoken. How quickly can you be ready to leave?"
Still staggered, Lawrence collected himself and protested that he could not leave the allegiance at present, but would have to wait until Riley was well enough to rise from his bed. In vain. Yongxing did not even have a chance to protest before Hammond was vociferously arguing his point.
"We cannot possibly begin by offending the Emperor," he said. "The allegiance can certainly remain here in port until Captain Riley is recovered."
"For God's sake, that will only worsen the situation," Lawrence said impatiently. "Half the crew is already gone to fever. She cannot lose the other half to desertion."
But the argument was a compelling one, particularly once it had been seconded by Staunton, who had come across to the ship by prior arrangement to take breakfast with Lawrence and Hammond.
"Whatever assistance Major Hertford and his men can give Captain Riley, I am happy to promise," Staunton said. "But I do agree, they stand very much on ceremony here, and neglect of the outward forms is as good as a deliberate insult. I beg you not to delay."
With this encouragement, and after some consultation with Franks and Beckett, who with more courage than truth pronounced themselves prepared to handle the duty alone, and a visit to Riley below decks, Lawrence at last yielded.
"After all, we are not at the docks anyway because of her draught, and we have enough fresh supplies by now that Franks can haul in the boats and keep all the men aboard," Riley pointed out. "We will be sadly held up behind you, no matter what. But I am much better, and Purbeck also. We will press on as soon as we can, and rendezvous with you at Peking."
But this only set off a fresh series of problems. The packing was already under way when Hammond's cautious inquiries determined that the Chinese invitation was by no means a general one. Lawrence himself was from necessity accepted as an adjunct to Temeraire, Hammond, as the King's representative, only grudgingly permitted to come along. But the suggestion that Temeraire's crew should come along, riding in harness, was rejected with horror.
"I am not going anywhere without the crew along to guard Lawrence," Temeraire put in, hearing of the difficulty, and conveyed this to Yongxing directly in suspicious tones. For emphasis he settled himself on the deck with finality, his tail drawn about him, looking quite immovable.
A compromise was shortly offered that Lawrence should choose 10 of his crew, to be conveyed by some other Chinese dragons whose dignity would be less outraged by performing the service.
"What use 10 men will be in the middle of Peking, I should like to know," Granby observed tartly, when Hammond brought this offer back to the cabin.
He had not forgiven the diplomat for his refusal to investigate the attempt on Lawrence's life.
"What use you imagine 100 men would be in the case of any real threat from the Imperial armies, I should like to know," Hammond answered with equal sharpness. "In any case, it is the best we can do. I had a great deal of work to gain their permission for so many."
"Then we will have to manage."
Lawrence scarcely even looked up. He was at the same time sorting through his clothing and discarding those garments which had been too badly worn by the journey to be respectable.
"The more important point, so far as safety is concerned, is to make certain the Allegiance is brought to anchor within a distance which Temeraire can reach in a single flight without difficulty. Sir," he said, turning to Staunton, who had come down to sit with them at Lawrence's invitation, "may I prevail upon you to accompany Captain Riley, if your duties will allow it? Our departure will at one stroke rob him of all interpreters and the authority of the envoys. I am concerned for any difficulties which he may encounter on the journey north."
"I am entirely at his service and yours," Staunton said, inclining his head.
Hammond did not look entirely satisfied, but he could not object under the circumstances, and Lawrence was privately glad to have found this politic way of having Staunton's advice on hand, even if his arrival would be delayed. Granby would naturally accompany him, and so Ferris had to remain to oversee those men of the crew who could not come. The rest of the selection was a more painful one. Lawrence did not like to seem to be showing any kind of favouritism, and indeed he did not want to leave Ferris without all of the best men. He settled finally for Keynes and Willoughby of the ground crew. He had come to rely on the surgeon's opinion, and despite having to leave the harness behind, he felt it necessary to have at least one of the harness men along, to direct the others in getting Temeraire rigged out in some makeshift way, if some emergency required. Lieutenant Riggs interrupted his and Granby's deliberation with a passionate claim to come along and bring his four best shots also.
"They don't need us here. They have the Marines aboard, and if anything should go wrong, the rifles will do you best, you must see,"
he said. As a point of tactics, this was quite true. But equally true, the riflemen were the rowdiest of his young officers as a group, and Lawrence was dubious about taking so many of them to court after they had been nearly 7 months at sea. Any insult to a Chinese lady would certainly be resented harshly, and his own attention would be too distracted to keep close watch over them.
"Let us have Mr. Dunn and Mr. Hackley," Lawrence said finally. "No, I understand your arguments, Mr. Riggs, but I want steady men for this work, men who will not go astray. I gather you take my meaning." "Very good. John, we will have Blythe along also, and Martin from the topman."
"That leaves two," Granby said, adding the names to the tally.
"I cannot take Balesworth also. Ferris will need a reliable second," Lawrence said, after briefly considering the last of his lieutenants. "Let us have Theroux from the Bellman instead, and Digby for the last. He is a trifle young, but he has handled himself well, and the experience will do him good."
"I will have them on deck in 15 minutes, sir," Granby said, rising.
"Yes, and send Ferris down," Lawrence said, already writing his orders. "Mr. Ferris, I rely on your good judgment," he continued, when the acting second lieutenant had come. "There is no way to guess 1/10 part of what may arise under the circumstances. I have written you a formal set of orders, in case Mr. Granby and myself should be lost. If that be the case, your first concern must be Temeraire's safety, and following that, the crew's, and their safe return to England."
"Yes, sir," Ferris said, downcast, and accepted the sealed packet. He did not try to argue for his inclusion, but left the cabin with unhappily bowed shoulders. Lawrence finished repacking his sea-chest. Thankfully, he had at the beginning of the voyage set aside his very best coat and hat, wrapped in paper and oilskin at the bottom of his chest, with a view towards preserving them for the embassy. He shifted now into the leather coat and trousers of heavy broadcloth which he wore for flying. These had not been too badly worn, being both more resilient and less called on during the course of the journey. Only two of his shirts were worth including, and a handful of neckcloths. The rest he laid aside in a small bundle and left in the cabin locker.
"Boyne!"
he called, putting his head out the door and spying a seaman idly splicing some rope.
"Light this along to the deck, will you?"
The sea-chest dispatched, he penned a few words to his mother and to Jane, and took them to Riley, the small ritual only heightening the sensation which had crept upon him as of being on the eve of battle. The men were assembled on deck when he came up, their various chests and bags being loaded upon the launch. The envoy's baggage would mostly be remaining aboard, after Lawrence had pointed out nearly a day would be required to unload it. Even so, their bare necessities outweighed all the baggage of the crewmen. Yongxing was on the Dragon deck, handing over a sealed letter to Lung Yuping. He seemed to find nothing at all unusual in entrusting it directly to the Dragon, riderless as she was, and she herself took it with practised skill, holding it so delicately between her long taloned claws she might almost have been gripping it. She tucked it carefully into the gold mesh she wore to rest against her belly. After this, she bowed to him and then to Temeraire and waddled forward, her wings ungainly for walking. But at the edge of the deck she snapped them out wide, fluttered them a little, then sprang with a tremendous leap nearly her full length into the air, already beating furiously, and in an instant had diminished into a tiny speck above.
"Oh," Temeraire said, impressed, watching her go, "she flies very high. I have never gone so far aloft."
Lawrence was not unimpressed either, and stood watching through his glass for a few minutes more himself. By then she was wholly out of sight, though the day was clear. Staunton drew Lawrence aside.
"May I make a suggestion? Take the children along. If I may speak from my own experience as a boy, they may well be useful. There is nothing like having children present to convey peaceful intentions,
and the Chinese have an especial respect for filial relations, both by adoption as well as by blood. You can quite naturally be said to be their guardian, and I am certain I can persuade the Chinese they ought not to be counted against your tally."
Roland overheard. Instantly she and Dyer stood, shining-eyed and hopeful, before Lawrence, full of silent pleading, and with some hesitation he said,
"Well, if the Chinese have no objection to their addition to the party—"
This was enough encouragement. They vanished below decks for their own bags and came scrambling back up even before Staunton had finished negotiating for their inclusion.
"It still seems very silly to me," Temeraire said, in what was meant to be an undertone. "I could easily carry all of you and everything in that boat besides. If I must fly alongside, it will surely take much longer."
"I do not disagree with you, but let us not reopen the discussion," Lawrence said tiredly, leaning against Temeraire and stroking his nose. "That will take more time than could possibly be saved by any other means of transport."
Temeraire nudged him comfortingly, and Lawrence closed his eyes a moment. The moment of quiet, after the 3 hours of frantic hurry, brought all his fatigue from the missed night of sleep surging back to the fore.
"Yes, I am ready," he said, straightening up.
Granby was there. Lawrence settled his hat upon his head and nodded to the crew as he went by, the men touching their foreheads. A few even murmured, "Good luck, sir," and "Godspeed, sir." He shook Franks's hand and stepped over the side to the yowling accompaniment of pipes and drums, the rest of the crew already aboard the launch. Yongxing and the other envoys had already been lowered down by means of the boatswain's chair and were ensconced in the stern under a canopy for shelter from the sun.
"Very well, Mr. Tripp, let us get under way," Lawrence said to the midshipman.
And they were off, the high, sloping sides of the Allegiance receding as they raised the gaff mainsail and took the southerly wind past Macau and into the great, sprawling delta of the Pearl River. Chapter 12. They did not follow the usual curve of the river to Whampoa and Canton, but instead took an earlier eastern branch towards the city of Dongguan. Now drifting with the wind, now rowing against the slow current, past the broad, square-bordered rice fields on either side of the river, verdant green with the tops of the shoots beginning to protrude beyond the water's surface. The stench of manure hung over the river like a cloud. Lawrence drowsed nearly the entire journey, only vaguely conscious of the futile attempts made by the crew to be quiet, their hissing whispers causing instructions to be repeated 3 times, gradually increasing to the usual volume. Any occasional slip, such as dropping a coil of rope too heavily or stumbling over one of the thwarts, brought forth a stream of invective and injunctions to be quiet that were considerably louder than the ordinary noise would have been. Nevertheless, he slept, or something close to it. Every so often he would open his eyes and look up to be sure of Temeraire's form still pacing them overhead. He woke from a deeper sleep only after dark. The sail was being furled, and a few moments later the launch bumped gently against the dock, followed by the quiet, ordinary cursing of the sailors tying up. There was very little light immediately at hand but the boat's lanterns, only enough to show a broad stairway leading down into the water, the lowest steps disappearing beneath the river's surface. To either side of these only the dim shadows of native junks drawn up onto the beach. A parade of lanterns came towards them from further in on the shore, the locals evidently warned to expect their arrival. Great glowing spheres of deep orange-red silk stretched taut over thin bamboo frames, reflecting like flames in the water. The lamp-bearers spread out along the edges of the walls in careful procession, and suddenly a great many Chinese were climbing aboard the ship, seizing on the various parts of the baggage and transferring these off without so much as a request for permission, calling out to one another cheerfully as they worked. Lawrence was at first disposed to complain, but there was no cause. The entire operation was being carried out with admirable efficiency. A clerk had seated himself at the base of the steps with something like a drawing-table upon his lap, making a tally of the different parcels on a paper scroll as they passed by him, and at the same time marking each one plainly. Instead, Lawrence stood up and tried to unstiffen his neck surreptitiously by small movements to either side, without any undignified stretching. Yongxing had already stepped off the boat and gone into the small pavilion on the shore. From inside, Liu Bao's booming voice could be heard, calling for what even Lawrence had come to recognize as the word for wine. And Sun Kai was on the bank, speaking with a local mandarin.
"Sir,"
Lawrence said to Hammond, "will you be so good as to ask the local officials where Temeraire has come to ground?" Hammond made some inquiries of the men on the bank, frowned, and said to Lawrence in an undertone, "They say he has been taken to the Pavilion of Quiet Waters, and that we are to go elsewhere for the night. Pray make some objection at once, loudly, so I may have an excuse to argue with them. We ought not set a precedent of allowing ourselves to be separated from him."